everyone. I'm your host, Rillian, and welcome back to the Narnia Web Council. Today we have really big part of the movie. Well, I'll say a really important, essential part of the movie that we're going to be discussing today. Today I have Glumpuddle joining me. Hello, Glumpuddle.
Hello, great to be back.
And we have Warrior for Jesus joining us. Hello, Warrior. How are you doing?
I'm good, thanks, Rillian. Thanks for having me.
Oh, definitely. It's been a while.
Yes, it has. Good to be back.
Well, yeah, I don't think, Warrior, you haven't been here since the first part of the commentary, have you?
I think that's about right. First or second, yeah.
Well, we've always saved the... We introduce a glimpse of the best at the beginning, but then we save the best for last, so...
Oh, thank you.
Okay, we're running out of people. Bring in someone with a sexy accent. Ah, Warrior for Jesus.
Very nice.
Okay, today we're not watching... I just rewatched it the other day. The Undragoning is, I think many people would say, easily one of the top three most important elements of the book that fans would probably say they had to get right. Would you guys agree?
Absolutely. Yeah.
Yeah, I would say maybe one of the top three in the entire series, arguably, as far as scenes where, like, if you don't get that scene right, why make it at all kind of thing?
Yeah.
You've got to get that right.
Yeah.
It's my favorite scene in Voyager Dawn Treader, so yeah. Definitely important.
Yeah.
In the book?
Yeah.
Well, to kind of recap, the last discussion was all about the battle with the sea serpent and the battle in the Dark Island. But
it
intercuts back and forth between the situation with Eustace. Now, the battle starts off where Eustace is with the Dawn Treader. He fights off the sea serpent. The sea serpent grabs him, takes him under the water, brings him up. He's kind of wounded. Roop throws his sword into Eustace. That's how Eustace gets that sword. And Eustace, wounded, flies off and lands on an island. And this is, and then it, from you have Eustace's journey after this, kind of intercutting with. The sea serpent battle, but we're going to focus.
Yeah, isn't it just? I mean, I think that he like crashes on the sand. Then we cut back to the battle. Then we cut back to his eyes opening and Aslan coming. Is that how it goes?
Yeah, pretty much. And
okay.
And then it ends basically where he is transformed. And at first, I couldn't remember how did he get back on Ramandu's island. But basically, the camera shows him going up. Off of the island, the camera pans around, and then when he comes back down, he's on Ramandu's island. And so that's how transportation occurs. But there's several elements that we have really to kind of consider here. In the book, we don't actually witness the undragoning right there. Eustace is relating it to us. And obviously, in a film, I think that well, one of the big questions all of us had was just how would they portray it? And, Warrior, why don't you start off just giving some of your impressions on just the visual aspect, what you saw in the transformation sequence?
As I saw it in the book or the movie?
In the movie.
Okay, in the movie. I really didn't know how they'd approach this visually. I was hoping... that would be a very special moment. I'm not as much as I love Australia, I don't know if having it set on a sandbar was the right idea, because in the book it's a lush area with a pool of water, a well. It's a very intimate sort of moment, but the sandbar sort of made a bit of a barren moment, I guess. Like, I don't know. For me, that was a bit of a disappointment. Just that in the setting was different. And that's not going into the whole. Even the fact that it was changed quite a bit from the book, but just visually in the setting, yeah, that was.
That's an interesting point. I hadn't really thought of that. I think that was definitely a disappointment for me as well. Glumpuddle, how do you think it worked for you visually?
Visually, I guess I can kind of see what Warrior's saying as far as seeming a little bit barren and not as interesting as kind of what's in the book, where Aslan kind of takes Eustace to this sort of private place.
Mm-hmm.
It's a little more interesting than what's in the movie here.
Yes.
I think that there were, ultimately I was thinking about other things, I think, as far as, like when I think of visuals, I can think of other things like... in terms of thinking about how the scene was going to be portrayed visually, I was focused on, you know, are we going to actually see dragon skin ripping, and how do we show him, you know, Eustace ripping off multiple skins? And one of those things that I think, because Lewis, even though it appears it's not a dream in the book, it definitely has a very dreamlike quality to it nonetheless. And so whenever you have a scene like that, you're always wondering, you know, how are they going to pull that off? So visually, that's the part I was always most curious about, how that was going to turn out.
Yeah.
Hmm.
I think for me, it was, I was kind of disappointed with the location, because I wanted kind of a dreamlike setting, and this had an almost, a little bit of a mundane feel to it. Like, this is just something that's happening. It didn't feel, there wasn't that sense of huge anticipation. I didn't sense, really either time I watched the film, but I think that... part of it was just there was in the book. This is one of the things a book can do better than a movie, where he says, Eustace in the book says, come to think of it, I don't think the lion did speak, but I knew what he was saying. You know, that kind of thing. It's hard to think, well, how are we going to do this in a movie? But
yeah, there's just no way to do
right,
that in a movie.
But you have, you know, the lion coming up and starting to not rip it off of him, you know, kind of magically tear it off, and. You have Eustace trying to claw it himself, but there's really no understanding of what he's really doing, or you know, why is he trying to rip it off now all of a sudden? You know,
I don't even think it comes through. And I was just having an IM conversation with Starcat about this, and I don't think it. To me, it's if I haven't read the book, I look at it, and it just looks like he's scratching himself,
yeah.
And that's it.
Like why? You know.
Yeah, I mean, it's where Starcat was saying she thinks it comes through that, you know, he tries to rip his skin off and he fails and he looks tired and he kind of looks to Aslan. Then Aslan does it. And she felt that came through. I felt that you'd only really get that if you've read
right.
the book and you were looking for it.
Yeah, because I knew what was going on, but I didn't see it communicated. Go ahead, Warrior.
I agree because... Oh, sorry. I agree because I think... That didn't come through clearly at all. And like you, I've read the book countless times. It's a favourite of mine. And if we rabid fans can't even pick up on something like that, I think it's failed in communicating that message or what's being done. Like, with the skin ripping, it looked more like Eustace as a dragon. He took, scratched a little bit, like once. You know, he had a bit of a... Like if we scrape a bit of dirt off our clothes, you know, no commitment in it. You know, it was just there, and it's like,
yeah.
What's he doing? It's got
it felt
a bit of an
like
itch.
An Easter egg for fans more than anything else. I think.
There was any commitment. There wasn't any power behind. Oh, I really need to get rid of my old nature.
Mm-hmm.
I need to try and do it myself. I didn't get that.
Yeah, you know, you mentioned Gunpuddle the situation of. Just it felt like it was just kind of thrown in there for fans. You know, on the forum, Icarus said, he said, I did find the whole sequence to be entirely too short, and its significance felt vastly underplayed as a result. And I think I think it does kind of create a... I think he's got a point there, that it did seem kind of... It didn't seem like, okay, everyone in the audience, okay, quiet down. Listen, this is the most important thing going on in the story right now. You didn't get that feeling, which you did.
No, it was more like... It was more that it came out of nowhere, and then it was gone before you'd even had time to appreciate it, or not appreciate it, as the case may be.
What did you...
I think if we look at it as, you know, not comparing it to the book, we're just trying to look at this as a standalone film. It's more like the undragoning, the reason it has to happen is because Eustace has to put the swords together. It becomes more of a footnote in the battle rather than being more significant in
itself. Defining
moments. That's kind of what I took away from it. And obviously, most battles, it's what Peter Jackson calls battle fatigue is a problem.
Yeah,
a battle goes on too long. So like in the Two Towers, you would cut away to the Entmoot, for example, to give us a break. So this felt like this is just a thing we cut away to give us a break from the battle rather than being important in itself.
What did you think of Aslan digging his paws into the sand? Some people, Starcat, said that when she spoke to Flaherty after the screening, she said he said that they did it that way because it would have been an instant PG-13 if they'd put Aslan's claws into the dragon's skin at any point. So that's something to consider, but
Can I share my thoughts?
Yeah, go ahead. What do you think?
Okay, I've heard some people liken it to Jesus writing in the sand, you know, when they were trying to stone the woman for, I think it was adultery, but I'm like, no, it's over spiritualizing it, I think. For me, I didn't like that scene because it just seemed really lame. There wasn't the power behind it that's in the book. Like, it's meant to be, you know, Eustace struggling with his old nature, trying to get that off by himself. And then Aslan comes to the rescue because he's the only hope there is to remove the old nature and give him a new one. But scratching in the sand, it's just like, there's this disconnect. Like, why is scratching in the sand achieving that? I mean, Aslan can do whatever, but there's no method to the madness, you might say.
Yeah. Well, and I'm not sure... My interpretation of that... my interpretation of that was that Aslan was basically, essentially, he was using the Force almost. He was, you know, mentally kind of making Eustace change, and the scratching in the sand thing was kind of a. It's not that scratching the sand is what did it. It's that it was a way of visually communicating. Oh, Aslan is doing the changing right now, and that was actually one thing I thought that was a. I thought that was a really good idea. Like when that started. And it showed the sand. And I think it actually shows like some sort of, lightning flashes, lightning scratches kind of go through Eustace. So you do kind of get the sense, oh, Aslan is kind of scratching him. When it started, I really thought, oh, this is actually kind of a creative idea. I mean, I would have liked it much better if they'd have just found a way to do the skin ripping or something that felt a little more violent. Because in the book, it's just kind of a violent scene. It's a powerful, it's painful scene.
Eustace is vulnerable. To Aslan in the book. He's very vulnerable at that point, which is something you don't really get here.
I think the nature of it...
To finish the thought, I just think that the idea of the claws in the sand, I think it was a really good idea, and it started out... I wish if they had done more with it, I think I would have actually felt a little better about the scene. I feel like they had a really good idea here, and I wish they had developed it more.
I guess for me, I was just so fixated on the idea that they should do it like in the book. That is a defining moment. If you have trying to get rid of the old nature by yourself, and then the redemption of that when Aslan comes in, it is going to be a painful moment. There is going to be suffering involved because redemption is not an easy process, and I think even if it's a PG movie, you need to communicate that. Otherwise, you're losing a lot of the power of the story of that scene, especially.
I think I'm kind of with Glumpuddle. I didn't really mind the scratching in the sand. I thought, okay, this is I thought it came across very clearly. Yes, Aslan is the one doing this. I think that my problem wasn't so much him. I did kind of like it. I thought it was very creative and a visual way of telling it beyond just, oh, yeah, he's going to rip it off. I think my problem was that just from Eustace's end, it didn't look like it was actually ripping off. It looked like there were just, I don't know, like there were magical seams going
some
through.
Fireworks
and then all of a sudden, my problem was how it looked when he was actually transformed. I had this image of... I'm not exactly sure, but of him actually taking the dragon off of Eustace, whereas here it's more like it's a dragon Eustace who just turns into a boy and doesn't actually. It's not like the dragon skin actually goes anywhere. That's one of the things I loved about the book is that when even before he's transformed into a boy again, he looks down and he can see the ugly dragon scales right there, which you don't have here.
No.
Yeah.
So Glumpuddle, well, go ahead. You actually, another film or two came to your mind when you were watching this.
Yeah, well, when I was watching it and Eustace started to sparkle with the fairy dust or whatever, and he started to float up into the sky a little bit, I did kind of think, I remember very clearly, saying out loud, please don't, please don't, please don't, kind of to myself. What I was thinking was, please don't float into the air and then burst into, you know, a boy again. Please don't do that. Don't do that. And, of course, I'm thinking of Beauty and the Beast, which is kind
of
been...
I was thinking of Shrek. That's kind of, I admit.
Yeah, Shrek too.
Well, yeah, because the scene in Beauty and the Beast has been, it's been parodied before. And so I'm like, no, can I do something else than that? So I was disappointed when they did that. Thought they could have done something a little more original. I guess for me, it makes it such a very clean transformation. Mm. And one of the things that makes the scene in the book so powerful, I think, is that it is a really, I don't know if I necessarily want to say violent. I almost do, but it's a very sort of, it has a huge amount of impact in the book. It really hits you.
Mm.
And that seems important, that the process of Eustace changing back, because he's changing from the thing he's been his entire life, this prideful, you know, know-it-all, and it's changing into something else. That's going to be painful. That's not going to happen overnight. And so I felt that this cheapened that up a little bit and made it much cleaner. Oh, it all happened in an instant. And I know that later in the boat, Eustace says, oh, it was a good kind of pain, and he says all that. But to me, I think the fact that they felt the need to have that dialogue indicates that they knew it really didn't come through in the scene itself.
Yeah.
Mm, true.
Yeah. Well, what do you think about just where? Okay, let's talk about where it was placed in the story, and how that. How do you think that had an impact? You know, you originally, Glumpuddle, I remember you saying back when we were speculating about all this. Saying, hey, I really think it could work well to have Eustace, his transformation later on in the story, and get to know the bad Eustace a little more. Why do you start off on that? How did it maybe meet some of those expectations? How did it fail in what you hoped it might do?
Well, I never really counted on... I did like the idea of spending more time to get to know the bad Eustace, just in terms of pacing a film, in terms of filmic storytelling, that seemed more appropriate. I didn't count on having the undragoning in the middle of this battle. Mm-hmm. I didn't think that was going to happen. I envisioned it happening maybe on Romandu's Island or something like that, to where it could be more of the focus. Because what happens in the book is the entire story is on hold. There's nothing else happening in the story right now except this dilemma. You know, what are we going to do about Eustace the dragon? And indeed, when Aslan basically does show up just in time, as far as, you know, the crew is about ready to leave, they have to make a decision. We're going to leave without our dragon, or we're going to stay here forever? I mean, what are we going to do? Like, we have to make a decision. The book says, and poor Eustace realized that from day one he'd just been a nuisance. And, I think, and to me, I didn't get that sense of urgency in the book. Like, is there any particular reason that this transformation has to happen right now? I mean, couldn't Dragon Eustace have put the swords together? I think he probably could have. And but I'm just making the point that, like, there's so many other things. Yeah. I'm just making the point, I think that in the book, so much emphasis. In fact, it's hard to imagine it being possible to put more emphasis on it.
Yeah.
Because there's nothing else happening in the story. Like, the story cannot continue until we deal with this issue.
Mm.
And I was talking about that with StarCat. StarCat felt that she's like, well, as an audience, we know we're getting to the climax. We know that Eustace can't just stay a dragon forever. He's going to have to confront this very soon. And so she feels that the sense of urgency came across with that. And I think that in the book it's much more powerful, where you're like, basically, the story's on hold. The story cannot go on unless we deal with this issue right now. Not the next chapter, right now.
Yeah.
So in terms of placement of the scene, I thought that was one of my issues with it. Apart from what we already talked about, with it just being kind of a footnote in the battle.
I mean, I know Icarus was saying that he thinks that they made the right call in leaving the undragoning until later, but he wishes that it weren't, timing-wise, that it weren't placed in the middle of the battle. And so kind of that same thing... you know, it should be given more attention at this point.
Yes.
Warrior, do you have thoughts on this?
I think quite similarly to you guys. I think that it definitely... it was fine to have it closer to the end. That's the undragoning towards the end of the movie, but definitely the pacing was an issue, and the placement of it with the battle, because even in... even in a movie, it's quite easy to just have the undragoning as a scene alone, not intercutting with the battle or anything, because we need to understand the importance of that. And translating that from book to movie, that's not one of the problems with translating it from book to movie. That can easily be rectified. So I think they really... it was quite disappointing in that aspect, yeah. And in the pacing of it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And as some people... Here's a couple positions that some people took on the forum. I think it kind of... this kind of leads into, you know, where they place the undragoning has a big impact on a question that I know... You know, this came up a long time ago when Michael Fahardy said that they had made some changes to remove the appearance that Eustace earns his redemption. And apparently the story was written or presented in such a way that they said he felt he had to correct them. No, this isn't right. This isn't in tune with what Lewis would want to do. We need to change this. And apparently they made some changes. I'm not exactly sure what they were. But here's a couple positions. Wagga Werewolf 27. Yeah, he says that if you have the redemption of Eustace after the battle and finding the seven swords and everything, then it makes it look like he earned his salvation and earned the undragoning. He says this way it doesn't. He says especially as the vegetating lords at the table start looking like they're waking up after Eustace accomplishes his mission and after Eustace has to do battle with the Green Mist. So he thinks that because it kind of happened in the middle before everything's finished, that this way it's, you know, it doesn't look like he's earning back his redemption. The Aslan's Country said, I still feel that the placement of the undragoning scene makes it seem as if Eustace earns it. That Aslan changes it back because he makes up for his mistakes and some more by fighting the sea serpent. Even though Eustace later adds that he cannot change himself, the statement feels more like an afterthought than a confirmation. So that's, you know, a couple different positions there. What do you think, do you think that maybe... Well, why don't we start with you, Warrior? What do you think of some of these thoughts here? Do you think that the film gave the impression that Eustace earned his redemption?
No, not really. But I don't think it made it clear that he didn't either. It was more a confusion about what is going on. I just don't understand what's going on. This scene's happening, he's got a sword in his back and he's... you know, bit wounded, close to death, some might say, if it didn't have a PG rating. you know, there are some limitations that come with having a lower family-friendly rating. And I don't think you can have the true power of that redemption without some pain and suffering beforehand or during leading to that redemption. So I think, yeah, it wasn't very clear to me what this was all about. I didn't think he earned his salvation, but nothing really led me to believe that he didn't either. Until the following line, once he was back as a boy. But he didn't really have a horrible time as a dragon in the movie either. That led me to believe that, you know, this is a horrible nature. He needs to get rid of
it. Yeah. He's kind of having a better time now as a dragon.
Yeah, it was more like, woohoo, I can fly and I can pull the ship. And it's like, yeah, but the dragon's meant to be your horrible, sinful nature in its most pure form, you know? you're not meant to be having a good time. it just struck me as...
Yeah, see, that was an issue I had with... there's a scene where, remember, Eustace and Reap are flying towards Dark Island... And then Eustace starts retreating, and Reaper Chief's like, wait, you know, I'm just a mouse, you are a dragon, and basically talking about how awesome you are now that you're a dragon. And that seemed very contrary to the point in the book where Eustace feels condemned. He feels hopeless for being a dragon.
Yeah, that's a very good point.
And Reap would not have that attitude towards him. Reap just would not be, oh, you're a dragon. He'd be like, you need to think about your situation and learn to be like a true nun.
That's the thing that... I've always said that Eustace becomes a dragon because now he is on the outside what he really is on the inside, which is he loves you know, lording his power over people, and he's so prideful, he thinks he's so much better than everyone else. And actually, indeed, in the book, his first thought when he becomes a dragon is, oh, yes, I'm so much more powerful, I'm awesome. Then he realizes, oh, wait, this is terrible. Mm-hmm. So it forces him to look in the mirror and go, wait, what am I doing? And the book says he began to wonder if he was really such a wonderful person as he always supposed.
Exactly.
And becoming a dragon makes him, it makes him realize, I am a total nuisance, because now they're all wondering, what are we going to do with our dragon? How are we going to feed him? Makes him see what he already is. He's been this prideful, stuck-up know-it-all his whole life. And then what's so powerful about the undragoning is he finally has to, for the first time in his life, say, I'm helpless, I can't do it, you've got to do it, Aslan.
Yes.
Then Aslan does
it. I think you're hitting on something, Glumpuddle, because you know, I think we've been looking at this maybe through with the wrong question. You know, since that issue with Flaherty came up, he doesn't earn it. I kind of agree with Warrior. I think you could kind of read it either way. It's not really clear in the film whether he's earning it or not. In the book, it's just kind of a non-issue. Of course he's not earning it. I think that the better question is what you're picking up on. Is him being a dragon a real serious bad thing? Is it a real dilemma for them? You know, in the film, it's kind of like, well, I don't know, watching the film, it's kind of like, phew, it's a good thing Aslan didn't redeem him earlier, you know?
Exactly. I think that in the book, being a dragon is more of a handicap, and in the movie, it's almost a superpower.
Right, and it's sort of
exactly.
What's funny is that here you have kind of, it's kind of like the everyone in the story. You know, oh, you were a pretty good dragon. You know, everyone in the story kind of looks at it through the eyes of Eustace, his first sister. Oh, I'm powerful. I am a terror now. You know, everyone's kind of making that initial fallacy. So now that I think of it, just listening to you two, and even just reading some of this, I think really the bigger problem is that it's more like, well, this is a, you know, oh, what will Antal Butter is not going to like this. It's that kind of a problem. Well, he has to become a boy before he can go home, obviously. But it's you don't have Eustace breaking down and weeping. And it's the kind of thing, oh, well, isn't this kind of nice and useful? He can tow the boat, and he can do this and that. As opposed to, oh, my goodness, they can't do anything. They're going to have to leave him unless he... So it's like they're in the book, they're in a... They have no solution whatsoever. Not only can Eustace not tear it off himself, but no one can think of a solution to this problem, and Aslan is the one who gets them out of it.
But how are we to feed him?
Exactly. Yeah, how are we to feed him? Well, he can't fly forever, you know. here it's and like you said earlier, it's kind of a means to an end, in both the redemption to an extent and also the dragoning itself.
I think there's a misunderstanding of the theme of being a dragon in that they think, ooh, dragons are cool. And yeah, we all think dragons are cool. But in this situation, the dragon is indicative of the nature, the sinful nature.
It's not
meant to be,
ooh, cool.
This is fun. It's not
kind of feel like the point of the dragon in the book is to humble Eustace.
Yeah.
Now, Eustace has always been a nuisance to the crew. But being a dragon forces him to realize it, force him to confront it. Instead of, I think that's sort of the point of being able to read Eustace's journal, as we see how distorted his view of the world is. Mm-hmm. And being a dragon forces him to, I think it's a good slap in the face, a good bucket of cold water right in the face. Like, wake up, look in the mirror, see what you really are. And then the threat of being left behind again forces Eustace to say that from day one, I've just been a total problem for the crew. And you don't, and like you were saying, really, and it's in the movie, it's more about it's really obviously in the book, Eustace is also a help to the crew, but at the end of the day, being a dragon is a major problem for Eustace.
Not even just
in the book,
not even just a nuisance, but also he could have doomed the whole voyage, because in a sense, like if they, you know, kept him with them, it just doesn't work. Because all the looking for the food and all that, that's not practical. But also, even if he was just a dragon, they sent him back, you know, go fly back from island to island, back to Narnia. There's huge amount of stretches of of water between them. And a dragon, no matter how powerful it is, it's not going to be able to fly from one island to the next, back to Narnia, without dropping into the ocean and dying. Like, it's just not plausible.
Even you know, backtracking just a wee little bit into the film, you know, why, again, how is this a problem? Well, Eustace in the book clearly brings it on himself. He finds a cave and he's entranced with the gold like a lot of us would be, but you know, what does he do? He puts on the bracelet, he takes a nap there, dreaming greedy dragonish thoughts, we read, and it's that has a direct tie to why he becomes a dragon, whereas in the movie it's kind of a, well, you know, the only thing that you get that is that he was just kind of ignorant. Oh, well, everyone knows that Dragon Thunder is haunted, you know, or is
yeah. I think I kind of said in the podcast you're talking about that. I mean, like, although you can slice and dice it and say, well, you know, like in the book, it's very much Eustace's own internal flaws that result in him becoming a dragon.
Yeah.
And in the movie, it seems like more, oh no, it's the external force of the treasure that changes him. Well, that's technically true. At the same time, I think it is still Eustace's greed that results in him going for the treasure. So I think you could slice and dice it either way. But ultimately, I think the idea of it's Eustace's own greed that results in him being a dragon. I think that comes through fairly well in the film.
I might agree with you there, except that you have the green mist being something that's coming in, not only to tempt Eustace, but
that's
it's the
true.
Green mist is coming in to tempt Eustace in the same way it came in to tempt Caspian and Edmund. And you could say, okay, fine, so Eustace is more morally blameworthy for succumbing to the mist, whereas Lucy, in all her wisdom and enlightenment,
subtlety.
I think it's less of a problem with Eustace. I think it's less of a problem with Eustace because we see who he was. I mean, this is even if the green mist wasn't there, this is behavior we would expect from Eustace.
Right.
Unlike Lucy, or especially Edmund and Caspian, where the moment the mist enters the equation, they start behaving in ways we have not seen them behave at all for the rest of the movie. So I think that it still comes across as it's Eustace who's responsible for being dragon, because if the mist wasn't there, I think the same thing would have happened.
But we all kind of see that. So maybe it's up for grabs as to whether Eustace does earn his salvation or redemption in the.
Yeah, I mean, movie. I don't think he necessarily earns it, but in the movie, to me, it almost just seems like it's not really a question the movie raises.
Yeah,
there's no real reason to question it, and
yeah, it's kind of a non-issue.
Yeah, it doesn't really. It almost doesn't seem relevant somehow.
Whereas we all
kind
of agree that somehow the issue of being a dragon itself, that the nature of that is definitely different and is a whole new...
Yeah, I think it's a huge point that Eustace, that being a dragon doesn't make Eustace feel like a total nuisance. I think that's a major point.
Well, you know, there's some... You said, Glumpuddle, that... or was it Worry? I'm sorry. Both two brilliant thinkers here. I'm getting your thoughts confused. One of you said... that the fact that there's some dialogue later on, or a little monologue, I guess you might say, almost reveals that they knew it would, that the scene of the Dragoning wouldn't actually carry everything. And we do have a little piece of dialogue. It was actually one of the first parts of the film we saw before, as far as a full scene, before the film came out. And seeing that scene, I was pretty positive, actually, about what was going to happen with the Andragony.
Yeah.
So I was looking forward to it. I mean, do you... go ahead.
I remember seeing that scene and having a pretty positive reaction to it. There's also a bit about Ascent Country, what's it going to be like. There's some good stuff in that scene. I do remember saying, just kind of as an afterthought in one of my videos, I was like, this is good, but I hope this isn't it. I hope that this is just confirmation of things that we kind of already sensed from the Undragoning. And I think that even Flaherty on some level seems to admit, you know, because Michael Flaherty admitted in, you know, the interview with Christianity Today, and I think a couple other places as well, that the Undragoning, it doesn't quite come through because, you know, they were struggling with keeping it PG-13, PG and all that. And so, well, we do have the dialogue later in the boat. So I think even Flaherty seems to admit that these concepts of It was the idea that it was painful for Eustace, the idea that he could not do it himself. Those really key points are things that they didn't really think came through, so they had to have Eustace simply tell you later. And I think that's something that, in terms of a film, like, let me, like, what's the point of telling me? Like, why even have the scene at all if you're just going to tell me later? I guess it should just come through in the scene itself. But look at Peter in Lion, the Witch, and the Wardrobe. He never has to say, oh, I'm finally living up to my responsibility as kind of the father figure in the family. He never has to sort of look at the camera and say that. It comes through just fine in the story. I understand that's Peter's arc without him ever having to say it. And I think that if I hadn't read the book, I don't think I would have been able to get this sense from Eustace's character unless he simply told me.
I think one of the things you just said, you mentioned afterthought, and I kind of went back to what Aslan's Country said on the forum, saying, even though Eustace later adds that he cannot change himself, the statement feels more like an afterthought than a confirmation. It's as if this is the first real clear communication we get that he couldn't do it himself, that he was actually trying to do it himself. Whereas, you know, yeah, if they had had a scene...
Some people, Starcat and some others probably disagree with that. Like, they would argue that... You know, that, oh, he's pulling on his skin, you know, that it comes through right there. But just in my opinion, I think that's something you'll only catch
itching
if you've read the book and you know what to look for.
Yeah, I would agree there. But this, the way he said it, I didn't get this feeling that he, okay, let me just put it this way. Let's say it did come through that he was trying to do it himself. You don't get the feeling that Eustace is desperately trying to scratch it off, and he's doing it again and again and again with failed attempts every single time, and he's becoming increasingly frustrated. That was clear in the book. You don't get that here.
Hmm. Can I just say I was...
Yeah, go ahead. I was going to go to next.
Oh, thanks.
We haven't forgotten you.
Thank you. I've got to say I was irked by just the line, you made a pretty good dragon or something, because it's just missing the whole point of it. Like, it's like, high fives all around, guys, dragons are cool, you know, it's not what it's all about. But other than that, I quite enjoyed the scene. It just wasn't drawn out long enough, like Glumpuddle said. You've got that, the waters, they're in the boat, you've got the white lilies, but they could have drawn it out to be, yes, more like a waking dream sort of scene. You know, as they're getting closer to Aslan's country, they are going to have that unreality, but not so much an unreality, but more of an extra realism, I guess you could say, about the world as they're getting to Aslan's country. It's becoming more and more the real world, just like with the old and the new Narnia. Spoilers for those who haven't read Last Battle, but I think it's showing that what we have in this Narnia is just a reflection of the real Narnia, of Aslan's country. And I'm not sure that came through as much as I loved that scene.
I mean, as far as like Aslan's country, I guess there are sort of two parts to this conversation. There's Eustace talking about his undragoning, and then there's what's it going to be like, Aslan's country? And when I saw this clip online before the movie came, I had a pretty similar reaction to both points. You know, it's like, this is good, but I hope this is reflective of something that's been building through the whole movie. Like with Aslan's country, I'm like, well, I hope this is an indication that they're going to be setting up the sense of awe and anticipation for Aslan's country, and that they're not just throwing it in there now. And unfortunately, the first time they mention Aslan's country in the movie is Reepicheep kind of mentions it to Lucy. And it's not like the book where all of the characters, all the main characters at least, are really excited about Aslan's country. It appears to be only Reepicheep and Lucy who know anything about it. He mentions it. Then we don't hear Aslan's country mentioned again, not once, I'm pretty sure, until this.
Actually,
so there's really only...
There's one moment, Glumpuddle, and I missed it the first time I watched the film. I watched it the other day, and Caspian, they're looking off, and they see the lilies, and Caspian says, Aslan's country, and Edmund says, well, we've come this far.
Right. Yeah, well, that's, I mean, that's like seconds before
the
scene.
Yeah, I think that explains the attitude, though.
Right. It's like, well, it's not so much going to Ascent's country because we got to go to because Ascent's country is the bomb, you know. And also, there's sorry,
like Disneyland.
I could have said that better. Right. Exactly.
I mean Fox
like,
Land.
There's just this. Also, there's a plot connect. There's a reason for going to Ascent's country in the book beyond just to go. Just, well, we're come this far, we might as well. You know, they have to free the lords. Or wake up the lords. In the movie, it's destroying the mist that wakes up the lords.
Right.
But again, there's only like Ascent's country. It's mentioned by Rippy Cheap, then we don't hear about it again until the very end of the movie, like minutes before they get there. So unfortunately, I don't feel this was something that was, unlike the book, this wasn't something that was building through the entire, even just an excitement about sailing to the world's end. That's something that Lewis introduces in chapter 2, develops, and there's an ultimate climax and resolution to it. Here it's mentioned at the beginning, and then we don't hear about it at all. Then at the very end, oh yeah, Ascent's country.
I agree, because if you
kind of mentioned that, didn't he?
Let me just say, and then you can go. The function of the plot here, it requires it to be an afterthought, because in the book, the quest to bring they find the Seven Lords, but they cannot awaken the three until they've left one of them, Rippy Cheep, beyond the world's end. One of them has to not come back. And there's something really profound in that. Oh my goodness, we've all sailed this far together. One of us we know is not going to come back. But here, it's completed. What else do we have to do? Well, you know, before we go home, we've already come this far. Let's go ahead and go to Aslan's country. It says something when, you know, I was reading reviews of the film from people who I presume had not read the book, and I found one review. All of the reviews said, in the little bit at the beginning, saying, "Here's the purpose of the film. Here's the purpose of the film." One of them said, "The purpose of this voyage is to destroy the evil green mist and to find the seven swords." Okay. One of them said, and also saying, "Find the seven lords." So I did found one review. You said that, you know, maybe seven or eight that I looked at. One saying, yes, they have to find seven lords. Not a single one mentioned finding Aslan's country as part of the purpose of the quest. And I think that says a lot.
Which is a real worry when you think about it, because I don't know about you guys, but when I think about the Voyage of the Dawn Treader, the two defining moments are Eustace's undragoning and Aslan's country, and the search for Aslan's country.
Yeah.
And if you change the focus, you're changing the whole direction of the film. You're changing the themes, the spirit of it. Everything that makes Voyage of Dawn Treader special makes it what it is. That what Lewis wrote.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, you mentioned the Aslan's country, and that's going to have to wait till the next episode. But do you have any concluding thoughts on just anything you want to say on the undragoning?
For me, I'd just like to quickly say that I was greatly disappointed in the undragoning, and despite all the flaws of the film, other than the undragoning, it's because of that scene that I had such a dislike of the movie in general, in thinking it's a mediocre adaptation, mediocre movie, because I felt they really... really stuffed up that scene, the undragoning. It was meant to be the pinnacle of redemption stories, I guess you could say, in terms of fantasy adventures or whatever, anything like that. It's the pinnacle of, for me, of the story, as well as Aslan's country. But if you if you misinterpret and take away the power of that scene, which defines much of the book, then you're missing out on the message and the intensity of what makes Voyage of Dawn Treader so special to so many readers. Maybe not to all, but to so many readers, because even those who are non-Christian or whatever, they can recognize, hey, there's something special about this.
Do you guess, Warrior, that, I mean, it's weird hypothetical, but could you guess that, let's say you'd walked away from the movie, everything pretty much being the same, except let's say the undragoning, you felt it was great, it had done justice to the book. Do you think you would have overall liked the movie?
Overall?
Yeah, if that had been the change.
Yes. not thinking it would be great or whatever, but I'd be more favourable to it. Yeah, definitely.
Yeah, I mean, I think I might agree with that. Just because, well, I don't know if I would have liked it overall, but I would have liked it. I would have disliked it less because overall, I thought they did a decent. Like, I liked Will Poulter. I thought there were aspects of the use of his character they did right, and so if they had really wrapped that up well, I think I would have felt better about the movie in general. But I just look at the book, and to me, Eustace's journey in the book is that he's this prideful, stuck-up know-it-all. He thinks he's so cool, and he has this distorted view of the world and himself. Then being a dragon makes him realize he's a total nuisance, and it humbles him. Aslan comes along. For the first time in his life, possibly, Eustace has to admit that he's helpless and can't do something. And this is an incredibly painful, violent process for him, being turned into his, you know, the new Eustace, Lewis says it. I don't think those are the three main things. I don't think any of them really come through in the film, at least not very strongly. But honestly, even if they had gotten all of those points right, I still wonder if it still wouldn't have been very powerful because of the fact that it's in the middle of the battle. So it's like, even if they had done all those things right, maybe it still would have been watered down by the fact that it was it's sort of just a break from the battle rather than the book where it's the whole story's on hold. There's nothing else going on. So, and then the conversation, the vote afterwards, having to tell us, you know, everything because it doesn't come through in the scene itself. And of course, there's all the stuff about Aslan's country they're talking about as well. I wish they had more building the excitement for that. And then even the reason they go to Aslan's country is more of an afterthought. Also in the book, I mean, there's an eloquence to the fact that in the book there's basically two main things. There's a search for the Seven Lords, then there's Aslan's country. Those are the two things that drive the book. And then they ultimately come together because in order to wake the Seven Lords, they have to go to Aslan's country.
Would you believe it? It's connected. It all ties together.
So there's an eloquence at the end.
It's connected. It all does tie together.
Mm.
Yeah, it ties together very well. It's like Aslan's country, they have to go to Aslan's country in order to wake the lords in the book, and in the movie it's just kind of, well, we come this far, we might as well. So it doesn't feel as there's a wonderful eloquence to it in the book, much less so in the movie.
True, I agree. Yeah.
Well, I think that your last statement, that there's an eloquence that the movie lacks, I think that sums up a lot of my thoughts, and I shan't add to any redundancy here, but yeah, you both had some really great thoughts, and even walking away from this discussion, my thoughts on the scene are a little more enhanced than they were going in. Just thinking of what should we be looking at, and the whole discussion on just the situation of being the dragon. What does the dragon represent? I think that's a huge element that maybe I was not thinking as much about. But anyway.
I think this whole issue raises. It's an important part of questions like, you know, what should the movie be rated and how important everything that should be. I mean, personally, I just think they should make the movie. They should try to capture the impact of what Lewis wrote and not worry about the rating. And I think it may be that this scene required a PG-13 rating. If so, I think that's what they should have done. Maybe that was the only way to capture the power.
Well,
of what Lewis
they
wrote.
I was watching the commentary, and Apted said that they already the sea serpent scene, you know, it got them a PG rating basically or equivalent in the US and UK, but, you know, Germany, France, and a number of other countries, they basically gave it the equivalent of a PG-13, you know, and we know that I think Prince Caspian got the same rating that The Matrix got down in Australia.
Yep.
So I think that, they should have been a little more, you know, just make the movie, you know, as it needs to be made and fight for it if you need to.
I reckon just a reminder to our listeners that we are really passionate about the books, the Narnia books. We're not digging into them just because we enjoy doing it. We would have loved for this movie to be great.
This is my favorite book. I would have been happy if I felt the first two films were terrible adaptations and that this one was magnificent. I think I would almost be happier then than I would be now. It's terrible to say. It really is terrible to say, but...
And I liked the first two films overall. Not that they're perfect, but I overall liked them. I wish I could say the same about this one. It's disappointing.
Well, next up, we'll be maybe not the exact same group here, but some of us will be discussing.
It's all come down to this.
Aslan's country.
The emotional farewell. I'll be looking forward. I don't know if I'll be a part of that one, but I'll look forward to hearing it either way.
All right. I look forward to it, that's for sure. Thank you very much, Warrior, and thank you very much, Glumpuddle. This was great.
Thanks, guys.
Always is. Bye.